Thank you
Very
for
cool.
coming.
Yes.
So there are rituals that take place every year in many synagogues before Rosh Hashanah. So one of them, we start saying Slichot, the special penitential prayers of the season. Another one, the Paroches, before by the Aron Kodesh, is changed to a white one. And then a third ritual, maybe taking place a little bit less than it used to, but you bring up the box of Birnbaum Machzorim from the basement, wherever they kept it, so everyone can use it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And I think it's really quite amazing that this Masa that was published in 1951 is still being used. I mean, I do think that there's been it's particularly in just the very recent past, the last maybe 5 to 10 years, there's been a move that shuls have been moving away from it. But I will say that when I started leading Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur davening at one of the shuls in Silver Spring, Maryland, where I live, they told me, and this was about 6 years ago, they said to me, the Birnbaum Machzor is the Machzor we use. So the congregants may be bringing their own, but if you're leading the davening, you use the Birnbaum. And I thought, well, that's really astonishing. This is a book that's not only is the book old, but the book has been out of print for since the 1990s. It has not been reprinted in the last 30 years. Part of that is because the publisher, Hebrew Publishing Company, one of the largest, most important publishers on the Lower East Side, in the early and mid 20th century America, they went out of business around the year 2000. Their last owner, Charles Lieber, died in 2016. For sure, a machzor, unlike a siddur, takes time to turn over the stock. So a machzor, if it's only used a few times a year, it's going to be in better shape than a siddur. And that's, I think, part of the reason the Birnbaum has had the longevity it has had. And
Hi,
I
good
think,
afternoon. Can I interrupt for a second?
sure.
We Birnbaum lovers, we love our Birnbaum Machzors. You know,
Yes.
it's like an old friend. It's like having a friend with you on Yontif. I mean, you know, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is once a year, and the Machzor is not a sitter. And if you grew up using that, then it's like having a friend with you. And so that's the excuse for the Birnbaum users, and we can track them down and find them in used bookstores. And
Well, for sure. Yeah, I mean, here's my copy that I got.
yeah,
Actually, this is the sitter. Sorry, I have a
that's the
machzor also.
sitter.
This one's the sitter, but yeah, I have
That's
the
cool.
machzor
Yeah.
also. But I should say also, I mean, the machzor, yes, is still being used, and there's many good reasons for that. And it can be a friend. I mean, the pages from which
I
we've
know there are
prayed
many. There are many
for
newer
years.
and more interesting machzorim, but I'm going to get out of your conversation now. I just heard you talking about that, and I'm a Birnbaum lover.
That's great. I'm sure a lot of people here are, and I have tremendous respect for him, and we'll talk a lot more about what he did and also my role in his legacy, because I do have one actually. When the Birnbaum Siddur was first published in 1949, so 2 years before the Machzor, that was also very widely used for decades, and some people still use it today for sure. But in shuls across the United States, across Canada, other places in the world, other English-speaking synagogues, this was a widely used siddur. I remember growing up in Philadelphia, so we're talking like in the 90s. So the gabbai, he would always call out the pages for the art scroll, but also for the Birnbaum. I remember just so stuck in my mind on Yom Tov. So before Musaf, we say the piyut ka keli, and he'd always be like, whatever page it was in the art scroll, and then 607B in the Birnbaum, because it wasn't in the initial edition of the Birnbaum, but he added it into a later edition. Birnbaum probably didn't like the piyut ka keli very much. That's my guess. It's a late piyut. It's not like an early one from like the ancient classical period or the medieval period. It was written probably in the 16 or 1700s. 1600s, I guess, it appears in the Siddur of the Shlah. So it's a Kabbalistically influenced piyut. So my guess is that was not as much his thing. So maybe that's why he didn't include it in the first edition, but it did end up in the later editions as well. But anyway, despite the popularity of Dr. Birnbaum's Siddur and his Machzor, there's not so much known about him. There's not very much written about him. When he died in 1988, there was less than a minion at his funeral. 4 years, his gravestone of 8 words had three errors on it. And I'll show you the source sheet now, and you can see. So here we have Dr. Philip Birnbaum on the left. And on the right, we have his old gravestone. And you can see his name is misspelled. It has Philip with two L's, should only be one L. It has his birth year of 1905, which there's some debate over his birth year, but 1905 is certainly not correct. And then it says over here, renowned author and scholar. You can see the renowned is spelled with a U, should have a W. So clearly this was not put together with the greatest care. And we will talk at the end about what happened, because now there's a new gravestone. So you see this person who had such this big influence, and we have here a number of his fans that did not was not what in after he passed away, he was somewhat forgotten. So he was probably born. Let's talk a little bit about his biography, and then maybe I'll look at the chat a little bit. Let's talk about his biography. He was probably born in 1901. He was born in Czarnowiec in Poland, which is about 35 miles north of Krakow. He was the youngest of three children. His family remembers him sitting at night at the table with books and candles, always reading, always studying. He mostly was self-taught. We don't know if he attended. His family is not aware that he attended a yeshiva in Europe. But he emigrated to North America in 1920 on his own, without his family, first to Montreal and then to New York. Unfortunately, his family did not come with him. Most of them, tragically, were killed, murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. His sister Blima did escape, and she moved to Tel Aviv, and he was close with his sister. She predeceased him. After a short time in New York in 1923, he went to Birmingham, Alabama. Why did he go to Birmingham, Alabama? One interview with him suggests that he wanted to escape the crowds of New York. It didn't suit him. He was the principal of the Talmud Torah in Birmingham. An important member of the Orthodox Jewish community there. He went to college there at Howard College, which is now called Samford University. It's actually a Southern Baptist affiliated college. And he financed his education there by lecturing in Greek and Hebrew, clearly very, 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 very knowledgeable, very, very bright at a young age. In 1935, he left Birmingham. He moved to Philadelphia, and there he attended Dropsy College, which was one of the premier places for Jewish studies, academic Jewish studies. At the time, he earned a PhD in 1939 for a critical edition of the Arabic commentary on Hosea of the medieval Karaite commentator Yefet Ben Ali. Sounds really, really obscure, but I mean, PhDs often are. I will also point out he is not the only important Orthodox Jewish scholar of the time to receive a PhD in Karaite studies. The other one was actually Dr. Bernard Revel, the first president of Yeshiva University, who also got a PhD in Karaite studies from Dropsy in 1912. When Dr. Birnbaum, now Dr. Birnbaum, was in Philadelphia, he was the principal of the Camden Talmud Torah, which was in New Jersey near Philadelphia. He lived in Philadelphia, though. In 1943, he moved again, this time to Wilmington, Delaware, at the invitation of one of the rabbis in the community. And he stayed there for 20 years, heading two different Hebrew schools, first the Associated Hebrew School, and then one called the Advanced School for Jewish Studies. He was very well respected and important in the community there. And so in let's talk a little bit now about his publishing career. So in 1944, the Hebrew Publishing Company, he submitted to them, and they published an abridged version, a version of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. This is his first work. Now, this is not a full translation of the Mishneh Torah. It's took the text of selected passages. What he did, though, is he put the Hebrew in a nice font. He put the Nekudot in so it's easier to read, and he also put explanatory English notes at the bottom. It was a wide, popular work, and Hebrew Publishing Company at that point said to him, "Can you please do the Siddur for us? We need a new edition of the Siddur." And so indeed, that's what he did in 1949. He published his Siddur, which was wildly successful. It was sold apparently 300,000 copies or more by the time of his death in 1988. Probably outsold any other English translation. The 1951 Masoret we talked about at the beginning was similarly popular. So I'd like to explore mostly in this class. So what was special about Birnbaum's Siddur and his Masoret? What was it that really caused them to take over and just be so beloved and so popular for so many years? And to do that, we'll understand a little bit of the historical context of what was going on in terms of Siddurim at the time and what Dr. Birnbaum's innovation was. And then I think we'll also be able to talk a little bit more through this process about some of the other things he did during his life. And then we'll get back to his gravestone at the end. I'll leave you in suspense about that until the end. Let me just see very quickly if there's something in the chat I want to talk about. Eric says, my wife is the direct descendant of David Werblowski, the founder of the Hebrew Publishing Company. The family owned the company for decades. Yeah, that's my understanding. If you have, Eric, if you have any additional information about this, I'd be happy to talk to you offline afterwards, actually. I know at some point the family sold it, and I believe then it was sort of in the basement, it conducted out of the basement of this Charles Lieber for a while until just going defunct. But I never heard exactly the full complete story about what happened to it. Okay, and then we have a link to the series about Karaism. Yeah, that was very very interesting one. Is there a problem with the screen share? Can people see the source sheet?
Yeah, all good. It's all good.
Okay. All right.
No. No.
No. I know, I see it fine.
Yeah, it's pretty clear.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
I'm seeing just the matzeva and the picture of him.
Right. That's all
Oh,
the
yeah,
U.S.
that's on the source sheet. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You can go ahead, Dr.
Okay.
Shack.
Okay, great. Okay, so just to set the stage a little bit for what was going on before Dr. Birnbaum Sitter. So Ashkenazi Jews begin to immigrate to the United States from Europe between 1881 and 1924. These Jews are largely Orthodox in this wave of immigration. Now that doesn't mean that everyone is Shomer Shabbos. I mean, many people were not for all sorts of a host of reasons. But they are attending Orthodox synagogues, many of them. And there is no American sitter, a standard American Ashkenazi sitter at this point. They're bringing various editions with them from Europe, and there's a great demand for new editions as they come. So Hebrew Publishing Company is trying to keep up with this demand, and they're just printing all sorts of different editions of the sitter. So you often will have Hebrew text from one European edition and some English translation they commissioned for another. Oftentimes they're just sort of pasted together without much rhyme or reason. They don't really look all that great. They're not always that easy to follow, and we'll just see a little bit of this in a second. But they certainly leave something to be desired. Reform congregations at the same time are really all moving toward the Union Prayer Book, which is like a standardized reform sitter. In the Orthodox synagogues, there's no standardization of any kind at this point. And one of the things the conservative movement tries to do early on in the 30s is standardize the sitter. They have a Morris Silverman did an edition of the sitter for conservative synagogues and also a Mafzer around that time. And they're big into this. But in the Orthodoxy does not have this level of standardization. There are some good English Siddurim that have a clear typeface and are easy to use. There's the one by Simeon Singer from the UK. But it is used in America, but it doesn't really get there as widely. I want to quote for you in source number one here from Herman Wouk, the famous novelist and author. He has a book called This Is My God that maybe many of you have heard of or read. I think it's really it's a classic, and I kind of wish it would come back. Maybe we'll have to give a class about that sometime too. It feels like almost as if Rabbi Jonathan Sacks writing about the issues in the 1950s. It's very, very well written. So here's what he has to say about what's going on in shul at the time. And he says, the worshiper is handed a prayer book that strikes him as a jumble, with English translations that for long stretches make little sense. He is apt to observe preoccupied and inattentive worshippers reeling off Hebrew with few external symptoms of devotion, or whispering together while a reader chants a long sing-song. Now and then everybody stands, he cannot say why, and there is a mass chant, he cannot say what, or if he dimly recalls it from childhood, he cannot find it in the prayer book. The time comes when the holy scroll is taken from the ark for a parade to the reading desk, the bells tinkling on its silver crown. The reading in a strange oriental mode seems endless, and he observes that it seems endless to some other worshippers too, who slump in an unfocused torpor, or chat, or even sleep. The skeptic leaves early if he can, well satisfied that his views are sound, that his religious fancy was a temporary touch of melancholia, and that if the Jewish God exists, there is no reaching him through the synagogue. A very, very colorful picture that Wook is painting here of what it was like in shul maybe in the 40s, 50s, that time. And remember, these are often people, already now we're talking about second generation people, you know, whose parents maybe came to the United States. The children, for various reasons, couldn't get the Jewish education, or their parents didn't want to give them the Jewish education. So they're coming to shul, stored out of this, you know, out of tradition. But there's less for them there than there might have been for their parents and the sitter. And I think the point of note here in particular is the prayer book strikes them as a jumble. The English translations make little sense. And we'll talk a little bit about that and what Birnbaum tried to combat in this regard. So let me just show you here. Let me just give you an example here. Here's a machzor the Hebrew Publishing Company published in 1903. I have this machzor because my grandfather gave it to me. I don't think he ever used this either. This must have been from his parents or even grandparents. And here's the cover. It's like very pretty. Someone must have done a very nice, maybe someone, I'm not sure this is the original cover either. But it's called the Form of Prayers for the Feast of New Year with English translation. And I didn't actually copy the English translation here. Maybe I should have done that, but I'll just say the English translation doesn't always match up to the Hebrew. That's problem number one. Like in English, you'll have a prayer, let's say, for the government of the United States, but the Hebrew on the same page is actually a prayer for the Emperor Franz Joseph in Austria. So you'll have things like that. But I just want to show you, even in the Hebrew itself, how difficult it is to follow. I actually, one year, not so long ago, maybe 5 years ago, a year I wasn't leading davening. I took it to Shul on Yom Kippur, and I said, let me try to daven from this and see what happens. So I tried. So you have over here on this page, V'chol Ma'aminim. That's one of the piyutim that are said in the repetition of the Shmona Esrei on Yom Kippur. So after V'chol Ma'aminim, what happens here? Says, my Yiddish is not amazing, but this is easy enough. I got this part. It says, Dechazen zogt uvechein tein pachtecha biz memshalas adom min ha'aret. So it says, after B'chol Ma'aminim, the Chazen says the paragraph uvechein tein pachtecha, and he goes a couple more paragraphs until the end of memshalas adom min ha'aret. Okay. Doesn't give you the Hebrew, and it's elsewhere in the Machzor, but you have to find it. And then we have the next piyut in the repetition of the Shmona Esrei, V'yeo sayu kola avdecha. This one, for whatever reason, they don't give the Nikud. All right, fine. And it's in a different size and font. And then we have some more Yiddish. Let's see what it says. Dan zok der chazen v'simulachata. Then the chazen says the paragraph simulachata with nechateinu, that paragraph v'chodesh hashvi, that paragraph biz l'reach nichoach yishayel Hashem. And he goes up until the end of the carbon of that paragraph that talks about the carbon. And then I think it starts to realize it's just told you a lot of stuff, but it's not actually here. So it gives an explanation. It says, man find it as by the Shmona Esrei. Okay. If you want to find it, go back to the Shmona Esrei. It's there. You'll find it. So not the easiest machzor to follow. And this was typical of what was going on in the early 20th century in the Sidurim and the Machzorim of the time. So this is what Dr. Birnbaum was trying to fix when he published his Siddur. So we'll see source number 3, 4, and 5. I've copied a number of paragraphs from the introduction to the Siddur. And you can also see a little advertisement on the side here, which says some of the same things in even more shortened version. But let's look at source number 3. This is from his introduction. He says, for no sound reason, the pages of the Siddur are broken up by several type sizes, which have the confusing effect on the eyes of the reader. Those who learn the contents of the prayer soon discover the emphasis suggested by the larger type is in most cases no emphasis at all. Why, for instance, should one part of the Shema be made to appear more prominent than the other? And you've probably all seen Siddurim like this, that have these multiple type sizes. Let me give another example here. Maybe some of you recall the Shiloh Siddur. So this is the Siddur that I got when I was first learning to daven in first grade. This was like 1991. Now, like in my kids' schools, they give out the Art Scroll Chinuch Siddur. But in the Shiloh, I think the reason they gave out the Shiloh is because the Shiloh has a very big type, and that makes it, I think, in some way easy to follow. The only thing is that the type, throughout the Siddur, the size is different in different places. And let's say also you want to daven Mincha during the week. Not there. You have to know what to do. You have to know you have to say Ashrei, You have to flip the Shmona Esrei, flip to the Tachanun, flip to Aleinu, but there's no actual separate weekday mincha service in the Shiloh Seder. And this gets us now to paragraph number four here. And he, when he's talking about these other editions of the Siddur, he says, what does it all mean? The answer can be put in one word, confusion. As a result of poor arrangement and inadequate instructions, comparatively few worshippers ever succeed in properly reciting the full Musaf B'Chol HaMoed Sukkos. And the reason I think he singles out Chol HaMoed Sukkos is because in that Musaf, every day it's different. So you're saying you're reciting a different carbon because the number of the bulls went down from higher amount to the lower amount for a total of 70 over the course of the Yom Tov. So it's tricky if you don't have it clearly laid out. So he says in this volume, each of the services is arranged as a completely integrated unit so that the worshiper is not called upon to search from page to page and to commute from reference to reference. The directions are explicit, brief, and to the point. The traditional text is left intact, carefully vocalized, and divided into sentences and clauses by the use of modern punctuation marks. So a lot of what Birnbaum is doing and a lot of the novelty of his Siddur is really just in the layout, in basic formatting things, actually, which, as we saw, were just not always done in earlier editions. He's also very interested in making a readable translation. And we did talk a little bit about translation last time we talked about the Adler Machzor. So if you look in source number five here, he continues, he says, some translators, unfortunately, have failed in their task of making intelligible the meaning of the prayers. In their carelessness, they have imitated the antiquated versions of the Bible that abound in phrases like, yielded up the ghost instead of died, and filled the sitter with a mass of words which convey little meaning to the mind of the modern Jew. The general complaint that we do not understand what we say is an indictment against many translations of the Siddur. If we think about what Hermann Wouk was writing, he also said this, that the English itself is very hard to understand. So part of what Birnbaum wanted to do is make a much simpler English translation. And he continues over here and he says, a good translation ought to be authentic and free from deceptions. One must not read into the original what is not there. No new poetry should be introduced into the Siddur, presumably as the translation of the Hebrew text. The meaning ought to be preserved as close to the original as possible. So here he's, and we actually quoted this paragraph last time too, I think, because he's specifically talking here about the translations of Israel Zangwill, which we talked about at length last time. Zangwill was a novelist and poet from England who translated a popular edition of the Machzor in the early 20th century. And he, his translations were very poetic, and we're going to see just a little bit of that again. Here, and Dr. Birnbaum was very much opposed to that. But he does also say in the last paragraph I've copied for you here in source 5, that the pronouns thou and thee have been retained where they are addressed to God, since they convey a more reverent feeling than the common you. The diction has not been allowed to reach the level of everyday English in view of the exalted literary tone of the Siddur. He's also telling you, he's like, I'm still not going to make my Siddur sound like an everyday book. Thou and thee sound more reverent, even though, as we talked about in the first class, it seems originally they were actually the address to common folk as opposed to royalty. But nowadays they sound more reverent, so he kept those in the Siddur in his translation because he wanted the Siddur to be different than just everyday speech. Let's compare some translations here so you can kind of see what Dr. Birnbaum was doing as opposed to some earlier translators. Okay, so let's take the phrase Anim Zmiros Vishirim Erog Ki Elecha Nafshi Tarog Nafshi Chamda B'tzel Yadecha Ladas Koraz Todecha. This is from the Davening. This is the poem of Anim Zmiros that we say before the open Aron Kodesh on Shabbos morning in most shuls. So we look at that. I give you a little bit of that 1903 Machzor that I showed you, the one with the very difficult to follow directions. And the translation also leaves something to be desired, as you'll see. It says, sweet hymns I will sing, and songs I will indite, for unto thee my soul panteth. My soul longeth to dwell in the shadow of thy power, to learn all the secrets of thy mysteries. So I will tell you already, I don't know what the word indite means. I mean, I always thought indict was like in a criminal context. I'm a lawyer, so like indite has a certain meaning there. This clearly is a different meaning. Panteth, that's an interesting use of that word also. Again, it's a very old translation. My general feeling about this Machzor also is translation was done quickly. It was not someone who spent a huge amount of time trying to make it really beautiful. You see over here, I copied for your Israel Zangwill's translation, which we talked about Zangwill last time in his translations. But you can see there is difference here. He says, sweet hymns shall be my chant and woven songs. For thou art all for which my spirit longs, to be within the shadow of thy hand and all thy mystery to understand. So Zangwill, per his minhag, is rhyming the whole thing, which we talked about last time. He does that throughout all his translations of poetry. So you definitely see it's a much more elegant translation than 1903 Machzor. Now, because it's a poetic rhyme, though, it's not going to be as literal, which Dr. Birnbaum doesn't like very much. So you can look at his translation over here, this last one I put here in source number 6. He says, I sing hymns and compose songs because my soul longs for thee. My soul desires thy shelter to know all thy mystery. So it's shorter, it's more simple, it's more direct. I think that's pretty clear. It still uses thou and thee, because he said that's what he was going to do, because he feels that you should do to make it sound more reverent. Obviously, a more modern translation is not going to use that. And we talked last time a little bit about how Art Scroll really changed everything. And Art Scroll really was literal as you can possibly be, even keeping the Hebrew words in the order, the English translation in the exact same order as the Hebrew words were in, which doesn't always sound so elegant, but it certainly is very literal. We talked last time in source number 7 about how Dr. Birnbaum really, really, really liked his translations to be literal and really did not like poetic and over-the-top translation like Zangwill's, to the point where when the RCA came out with their Siddur in 1960, he wrote a very long and brutal, I would say, review in Hadoar about how much he disliked the translation. And we're not going to go into it. We talked about that last time. But I do think it's a good place to talk about some of what Dr. Birnbaum's other writing, and that is his Hebrew writing. So he wrote frequently. He had a column in this Hadoar, which was a Hebrew weekly. It lasted from 1921 until 2005. So it had a long publication run. It was a publication of the Histadrut Ivrit of America, which promoted Hebraic culture, and Dr. Birnbaum was served on its board. He also wrote for it, as I said, for many years. In fact, I once went to the Library of Congress. I took out all the volumes of Hadorah just to get a sense of how much he was writing for them. And he's writing periodically throughout his whole life up until just a few months before he passes away in 1988. He did book reviews. He did essays about Jewish history. And he just has so much knowledge of academic Jewish scholarship and traditional Jewish commentary and so many other things. It's really very impressive when you start to read his Hebrew writings just to see how much he knew. And of course, he clearly loved the Hebrew language. When he was in Wilmington, he taught a group of students consistently for 20 years, over the years, different people were part of this Chug Ivri, and he taught them all about the Hebrew language. I met people who, I think someone told me their mother was part of that group in Wilmington. So Dr. Birnbaum also, he was a scholar, and his training as an academic scholar definitely shows through in a lot of his work, and particularly in his work on the Siddur. One of the things he tries to do also is he tries his best to establish what he believes is the correct Hebrew text. I didn't give any examples here, but there are some that are well known about how he feels like one thing is right and he changes it. Like in Menis Sidurim, for example, on Shabbos, when you have the paragraph about the Kedushas Hayom, the sanctity of the day, the blessing over Shabbos. So it says, depending on which tefillah you're in, the words wording is going to be slightly different. So is it V'yanuchu Va Yisrael? Is it V'yanuchu Va Yisrael? Or is it V'yanuchu Vam Yisrael? And based on the Magen Avram, and which is Kabbalistically influenced, we assign different ones to different services. So in Marav you'll say Va, and Shachar and Musaf you'll say Vo, and in Mincha you'll say Vam. So Birnbaum doesn't like that. He feels we're going to try to just do it grammatical, and he thinks Va is the best. So he sticks with Va the whole way through. Some people were upset about that, but that was his view. Another one I haven't gone to the bottom of this completely. This one's a little more obscure, but maybe you've noticed this on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, because a lot of you apparently use the Birnbaum Machzor, and maybe sometimes the Chazon now is using something different. There's a piyut toward the end of the davening. What's it? Hold on. I don't know why I'm forgetting. Why I don't know why I'm blanking on it suddenly. But he rearranges the lines. So it's actually different in his machzor. He puts them in alphabetical order, even though traditionally the alphabetical order was not preserved. I don't know why I'm forgetting the name. Maybe it'll come back to me. Sorry about that.
Do you know Do you know whether he says titkabel or titkabal?
I haven't looked at it, but I'd be nearly positive that he would. I assume he would say, well, is this the same as like yitgadel versus yitgadal? Because if so, he would say he would move to a patach, because that's traditionally how it was in all the Siddurim. And like that, meaning like it's an Aramaic tefillah, so it's going to have the Aramaic vowelization. Those that switch it to like Yitgadel, like the Mishnah Berurah, they're doing it based on, it's complicated, but I think they're basically basing it on the idea that it's quoting a pasuk. It's quoting a pasuk, and they feel that at least that part should be the Hebrew vowelization, but that's not the traditional. That's not the traditional vocalization. So my guess is that Brembem would stick with the traditional one for that. So he was certainly also very scholarly, and he quoted a lot of scholarship. We see in source number 8, in his acknowledgments to the sitter, he has like a whole list of people. He says, in the course of his work on the sitter, the author has consulted many authorities for guidance. He is deeply grateful to Rabbi Chaim Heller for his illuminating suggestions. Rabbi Chaim Heller was a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University who was very interested in Hebrew language. And the writer is equally indebted to professors Louis Ginsberg, Abraham A. Newman, Chaim Chernovitz, Alexander Marx, Solomon Zeitlin, Saul Lieberman, Joseph Reeder, Israel Efros, Boaz Cohen, Abraham Heschel, and Simon Greenberg for their helpful advice and encouragement. And when I've given this share in the past, I've opened this up for let people identify some of the names if they want to. I think we have enough time here, so I'll do that again.
If no one is speaking, I was just commenting quite a variety. I mean, you know, Chaim Heller was very the Rav. Of course, the Rav totally looked up to Chaim Heller as a gadol b'Torah, and of course Chaim Chernovitz, you know, was a tremendous talmid chacham when he became a reform rabbi. Zeitlin also had quote unquote heretical views, according to some. Shaul Lieberman, of course, Mark Sturgis.
Well, they taught at JT.
Quite a list.
Yes, a lot of teachers at JTS here. We have Louis Ginsberg at JTS. We have Alexander Marx, who is a librarian at JTS. We have Abraham Joshua Heschel, of course. And then we have Saul Lieberman, right?
And Boaz Cohen.
Oh, yeah, he was there too, right? Yeah.
Boaz Cohen, who the Rav said his gittin are good, even though he comes from the conservative movement. He trusted him halachically. And very, very fascinating list.
Yeah. And Abraham Newman was, I believe, the president of Dropsy College. What else did I write here? I said that, Zeitlin was also a professor at Dropsy, and I think Rabbi the heretical views you're probably referring to might be his views on the Dead Sea Scrolls, possibly.
On Zeitlin?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know enough about him, Zeitlin, but I know people have problems with some of his views. Chaim Chernovitz, I've read a lot of his stuff. He's great. I love it. But
Chaim Chernovitz is really, really interesting. He was in Europe, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of a very innovative yeshiva in Odessa that taught secular studies, very uncommon at the time. And he comes to America and he ends up at HUC, JIR, Jewish Institute of Religion.
I believe he gave the hesped at Rav Yitzchak Elchanan's funeral, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, that's really interesting.
He was a student of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, you know, Specter, and I believe he gave one of the hespedim. So that's, and he writes fascinating stuff. His works are really amazing.
Yeah, no, I've read some of it also. He has a long, long work on the history of halacha, which I haven't read the whole thing, but it's kind of a combination of traditional stuff and scholarship, and so it's really, really, really interesting to read his stuff. Solomon Zeitlin, I believe he, unlike almost every other scholar of his time, he thought the Dead Sea Scrolls were late, actually, and that they were not authentic, Second Temple works. And because of that, Dropsy didn't, for many years, they didn't consider it important. So they didn't stock a lot of the scholarship on the Dead Sea Scrolls. They've rectified, I mean, the library now is part of the University of Pennsylvania Library. And I think they've tried to rectify that, but I believe that was his view. So you see that he's got a cross denominational, friendships and interests, and he's really trying to take things from whenever they come from. And really, he had that wide scholarly interest. He himself was, he used to say that in Wilmington, he didn't like to identify with a particular movement. It seems in all his views, he was Orthodox. I think that's important to say, just like Rabbi Hertz, we discussed in the first class, was certainly Orthodox, even if he had some non-Orthodox affiliations. But Dr. Birnbaum also, he had wide affiliations. And remember also that he was teaching in Hebrew school his entire life. He's not teaching in YU. He's not teaching in a yeshiva. He's really working with people who probably don't have so much Judaic background. He's really trying to improve that. And that was really what he devoted his career to. I also gave you a quote here in source number 8. Before we move on past source number 8, I should mention, as I noted here, this was only in the first edition. They took out these acknowledgments in later editions of the Siddur, which almost certainly says something about Orthodoxy and how it changed over time, and maybe not wanting to mention some of these people anymore in the Siddur. If you look over here in source number 9, his commentary and translation of Megillas Esther, you really see it very clearly, his interest in scholarship and his willingness to quote non-Jewish sources like Rabbi Hertz is on display. He says, diverse opinions have been held on the subject of the historicity of the Book of Esther, which is no secret that many scholars don't believe that book to be historically authentic. He is going to defend it from an Orthodox perspective. And he says, none of these historical objections, however, are successful in view of the ancient observance of the Feast of Purim, which forms a considerable presumption in favor of being founded on facts. Okay. And then he continues and says, according to the biblical scholar Samuel R. Driver of the 19th century, the sacred writer of the Book of Esther is well informed on Persian manners and institutions and commits no anachronism. So he's trying to prove the historicity of the Book of Esther by saying, look, it fits with the time period and it's using the proper types of language and it seems well informed on what was going on in the Persian period. But who does he quote for this? He quotes Samuel Driver, a biblical scholar, not an Orthodox or Jewish figure for that matter. So you see that he's certainly very interested in scholarship. I should also mention over here his Zionism. He was always a very strong Zionist. Started already in Birmingham in the 1920s. He was teaching his students about Herzl, about the poetry of Chaim Menachem Bialik. And if you look actually at the first edition of his Siddur in 1949, on the last page, he's got the Tefillah L'Shalom HaMedina. You can't probably see it here, but here it is. And I wonder, being that the Siddur was published in 1949, if this was one of the first times it appeared in print in a Siddur. And it's interesting, I think to see that. And I think above all, he really wanted to make Jewish texts accessible to the English speaking masses, regardless of their background. In 1983, in an interview that he did, he said, we are losing people because of ignorance. People are ignorant of their ignorance. My motivation is to teach. I'm a teacher, an educator. I want to help people remain Jews. And I think this was his standard. This is what he believed his whole life. You see this very much in his 1964 Book of Jewish Concepts. I have a copy of that here as well. Perhaps many of you have seen this or used this. It's really an amazing work. It's like an encyclopedia of Jewish ideas and concepts arranged alphabetically. Very accessible, yet also very scholarly. And in the introduction, he writes here in source number 10, the purpose of this book is to provide in a single handy volume the essential teachings of Judaism. It is written for those who want an up-to-date and easily intelligible account of basic Jewish concepts, a knowledge of which brings meaning to what may otherwise seem empty phrases. At the present time, when we are confronted with widespread indifference, we have great need of a spirituality based on genuine knowledge of our heritage. And I think that last line is just so important for what Dr. Birnbaum is doing throughout. That he really wants to create knowledgeable Jewish people, and his books are aimed at providing that knowledge. And he did this throughout. The Book of Jewish Concepts itself was very, very popular. It was in a third printing already by 1967, so within 3 years, it had sold out of its first two printings. There's a Jewish press article from around this time of a profiling Dr. Birnbaum, and it gives an anecdote from a lawyer. He walks into a Jewish bookstore and he says, I am an Am Haaretz. Give me Birnbaum's book on Jewish concepts. And then he goes home, he studies it with a group of other lawyers, he returns to the bookstore and proclaims, I have lost the title Am Haaretz. And you see a similar rationale in many of Dr. Birnbaum's other works. He's got The Treasury of Judaism, published in 1957 originally and then revised several times. He collects English abridgments of Tanakh, of Mishnah, of Gemara, Josephus, Zohar, Rambam, Ramban, down to Dr. Norman Lamb, but then also Mordechai Kaplan, and also Reform Rabbi Stephen S. Wise. So he's got like a range of Jewish ideas and concepts and things he wants you to know about, and he feels they're important to put in English for people to understand. 1976, he did something called the Concise Jewish Bible. This is really fascinating. It's a heavily abridged English version of Tanakh. It's only in English, and it's really, really abridged. And when I'm talking about abridged, I'm talking like Sefer Vayikra, 3 pages. And they skip everything, just have some of Parshas Kedoshim about holiness and about walking in the ways of God, some of Parshas Emor about the holidays, and some of Parshas Bahar about Shemitah and returning the land to its original to its original state. And again, this is not even written for Jews, I think, this book. I think that's pretty clear, that he was preparing this for sort of anyone who wants to learn more about biblical ideas and biblical concepts, but needs it in a shortened form. And I think this interest in Jewish education and making Jewish scholarship and the history of Jewish scholarship accessible to people is also in the Siddur. If you look at his introduction to the Siddur, in source number 11, he goes back to this theme. And he says, the Siddur is the most popular book in Jewish life. The whole gamut of Jewish history may be traversed in its pages. It is a mirror that reflects the development of the Jewish spirit throughout the ages. He continues, though, the Siddur passed through a long process of evolution until it finally emerged as a rich anthology of our literary classics. Judaism demands from its adherents a knowledge of the Bible and the traditions based on it. Many, however, lack the leisure or the aptitude for such study. Hence, the Siddur has developed in a way that enables every worshiper to become familiar with the various forms of Jewish learning and religious expression. The Siddur is a place to learn. It is regrettable that the Siddur, over which many generations have brooded and wept, has never been sufficiently appreciated as a vehicle for Jewish knowledge. And I think that's just such an interesting line. And I'll just read it again, because I think it's really so important to what he was trying to do throughout. And he says, the Siddur, over which many generations have brooded and wept, has never been sufficiently appreciated as a vehicle for Jewish knowledge. You think that, but maybe there's something missing from this introduction. When anyone want to think about what's very different about what you might expect here in this introduction?
Talking to God.
Yeah. What about prayer? Isn't the Siddur the book where you pray to God? It's just striking that in the first edition of his Siddur, he doesn't say that, actually, anywhere in the introduction. In 1977, when they did the new edition, then he has a whole extra section about that. Because I think he rectified that because he realized that that's really an important part of the Siddur. And I don't mean to suggest by any means that he didn't think that was an important part of the Siddur. But you see in the introduction to this first edition that he just felt, in a way even more important, was that I want people to learn about Judaism. And the way you do that is by reading the texts that are contained in the Siddur. And I think that's just a really interesting feature of his approach to education throughout. If you look, for example, in source number 12 here, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, he starts off his introduction to the New Korean Siddur. He says, prayer is the language of the soul in conversation with God. It is the most intimate gesture of the religious life and the most transformative. So he starts talking about how prayer is conversation with God, not about how the texts in the Siddur are texts where you can learn about Jewish history. So it's a different approach. Now, nearly all of Dr. Birnbaum's works were very popular throughout his life. His commentary on the Haggadah, when they reprinted it in 1976, they simply called it the Birnbaum Haggadah. That was the title, just because his name had such currency at that point. In 1983, he published what should have been his capstone work, and that was actually a new, complete Shul Chumash. But it is, indeed, another forgotten synagogue classic, because I don't think I've ever seen it used in a shul. I have a copy here. This is his Chumash. Hebrew Publishing Company, 1983. But it was not widely used, and there are probably many reasons for this. Hebrew Publishing Company, already in 1983, was on the decline. This is one of the last books they published, actually. It's also got flaws. I mean, there's very little commentary in the Chumash, much less than Hertz. The font and the typography are no better than the Hertz, even though it's 50 years newer. The translation is certainly more modern than the 1917 JPS, but because, you know, Birnbaum had his own ideas about translation, in the 1980s he was still using his these, his thous, and his thys, it doesn't work as well in 1980 as it worked in 1950. So that's probably why the Birnbaum Chumash didn't have the impact one might have thought it could. And for those interested more in the Bar Chumash, I actually in the hopefully in the next edition of Chakira, I have an article about that coming out. So you want to check out more about that. I have more to say about it there. So when he left Wilmington in 1963, he went to New York. And he lived very comfortably in his retirement there. I mean, I think there was quite a bit of royalties he received from his many, many sales of the Siddur and the Machzor and their many editions. In New York, he attended the Jewish Center in Manhattan's Upper West Side. And he received Yeshiva University's Mordechai Ben David Award and the body of work citation from the Jewish Book Council in 1986. But I will say he never married and he had no children. So he had family in Israel, but they weren't directly involved in his funeral. So it was left to his executor and friends to prepare funeral arrangements and make the headstone, which I believe is what led to the mistakes. So in 2021, I, being very interested in Dr. Birnbaum and his Machzor and Siddur in particular, I published an article about for Rosh Hashanah about the Machzor and its staying power. It was a widely read article. And someone reached out to me and said, hey, look, here's a picture of his gravestone. And that's when I saw the gravestone and I saw the mistakes. And at that point, I reached out to Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who was the rabbi of the Jewish Center when Birnbaum passed away. He's also a close mentor of mine. And he introduced me to Larry Kobrin. Larry, are you here? I think I saw you before.
Here I am.
Okay, yeah. So Larry's a very important part of the story.
5 minutes of fame.
Yeah. I think, Larry, I think you've had many, many minutes of fame. This is just one, but yes. And also Rabbi Yossi Levine, who's the current rabbi at the Jewish Center. And together I worked with Larry and Rabbi Levine and Rabbi Schachter. And we did some, looked into like who's in charge of the stone at this point. And basically the answer we came up with was nobody. So we were able to replace it. We raised money and we were able to replace it and rededicated it in 2022. You can actually, if you go online on YouTube or the Jewish Center's website, you can see the rededication ceremony. So I have here, over here, the new gravestone that I have on the source sheet for you. I did put the birth date as 1904, even though that probably isn't correct. I mean, one, I wasn't so sure at the time, but also it seems like that's the date he wanted people to use. Like toward the end of his life, that's the date he pretty consistently used for his birth date. And we put a nice English inscription, but also added some Hebrew, which was not on the original gravestone. I wrote an inscription here in Hebrew. I based it on the Machzor. You can see it. Hopefully it's make it a little bigger so everyone can see it. Let's see. Oh, no, I guess that much bigger. Okay. So I based it on there's a tefillah that we said, the Chazan says, on Musaf of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And I adapted it for Birnbaum's gravestone. And it reads like this in Hebrew, Horeh. I wrote on the gravestone, I wrote, Horeh pifio samo, shlo yikashlu b'shanam, lo yinakshu b'shinunam, which basically means he instructed the mouths of his nation so that their tongue shall not falter and they will not be ensnared by their words. And I think this is exactly what Dr. Birnbaum did, with his translations, with his elucidations, with his many other works, and with unceasing devotion. He educated Jews of all stripes and all backgrounds, and most importantly, he taught them how to pray. So I thought that was a fitting capstone to his career and something to put on his headstone. You can also see a picture when he was a little younger of during his time at Wilmington on the source sheet. And here I will stop. Let me first look at the chat, and then I'll open up the floor for additional questions. Okay, I will actually let me take down the source sheet also so then people can see me easier. Okay, Elisa says, this is my God is the first book I read about observant Judaism and was very influential to my becoming observant, having no Jewish education. And I still daven from a Birnbaum every day of the year. That's great. Yeah, I think both the Birnbaum Siddur and This Is My God are two very, very important works in American Jewish history. Ruth says, we gave our grandmother Shiloh Siddur when she was very old and her eyesight was failing. She loved it. I still have mine from first grade in 1956. Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think one really big advantage of that Siddur is that it has big type and it's easy to read. Chaim says Shiloh also has numbered lines, so it's probably intended as a teaching center. Oh, that's interesting. I haven't thought about that. Okay, yeah, I haven't looked into its history. Shvil Chadash by Hebrew Publishing was also popular in schools. Yes, I have seen that one. Yeah, I have seen that one as well. Ruth says that's indite with the C. Yeah. Oh, language trainers connect. Okay, indite is a very old-fashioned word and is different from indite. Yeah, that's what I figure. I think I even looked it up at one point, but I already forgot. Oh, Ruth says indite means write or compose. Indite is a legal word. Yes, okay. Okay. Rabbi Siegel asked, did Birnbaum go to JTS? And the answer is no. He got his PhD from Dropsy, but he never did any rabbinical training. And everything he knew in the rabbinical world, at least, was certainly self-taught. Chaim says, Birnbaum made many of his changes on the Siddur of Rav Yaakov Emden. Okay, Birkas Kriyat Shema. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, Rav Yaakov Emden certainly was one of the people who did try to modify the Siddur based on what he saw were errors that crept into it over time. Some of his changes are indeed reflected in all Siddurim today, actually, but again, many of them are not, and perhaps more of them are reflected in Birnbaum. Ruth says he values Yisgadal with two patafs. Yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah. Okay. Chaim says Birnbaum also wrote a book on conservative Judaism. Of Harlap described him as a figure who straddled both Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism and was accepted by both. That's interesting. I didn't know Rabbi Harlap did that. That's really very interesting. Yeah, Rabbi Harlap actually just recently passed away, but he was the head of Reitz at YU, the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, the rabbinical school, for many years. When I was there, he was still there. And yeah, I mean, certainly his master, his siddur, were used widely in Orthodox and conservative congregations. And he did have that cross-denominational appeal. And yeah, someone says here, I don't remember seeing those chumashim ever. Yeah, I never seen them. The Jewish Center, I believe, has a couple copies, although I will say when I was there and I looked for them, I couldn't find them. Chaim says, if Herschel Schachter and Ashir described Berman as a professor at JTS, was he incorrect? Yeah, I've heard that from other people too, not just from Schachter. I mean, like, that many people think that Berman well taught JTS, but he did not. He was just a Hebrew speaking teacher.
They probably based that because he thanked so many of the people from the seminary.
Yeah.
He never taught at the seminary.
Yeah. So Ashir says, wasn't his brother Dr. David Birnbaum longtime librarian at the Yeshiva Flatbush? No. Birnbaum is a common name, and there are many other Birnbaums, but he is not certainly not related to that person. As I said, like the rest of his family perished in Europe. He came alone. He had a sister who was in Tel Aviv. Eli Passau says, one interesting feature is an elucidation of 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael. Yes, and thank you for pointing that out, actually, because that was part of what he was trying to do. He says the Siddur is supposed to be a vehicle for Jewish knowledge. So he wants to, when there are things in the Siddur that are quintessential Jewish learning texts, he spends a lot of time commenting on them and explaining them because he wants people to learn more about them. So we have the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael, which are the principles of rabbinic interpretation and midrashic interpretation. So he spends some time on those. Judy says, I don't like his translation of Ma'alim Ayin to condone. Can you let me, where is that in the Siddur? Or Machzor?
It might be the Chol Ma'aminim.
Okay. Yeah, it might be Chol Ma'aminim. Okay, I have to look at that to see better what I think. But yeah, certainly, I mean, his translations are just his views, and like some of them are better, certainly better than others. Okay, that takes care of the questions in the chat. Does anyone else want to say anything in the 5 minutes or so we have remaining?
Yes. First of all, I have an apology for my wife when she interrupted before. She didn't realize that she was interrupting a class. She thought we were talking individually, and she was very embarrassed. But she had to go out because she wanted me to apologize for interrupting. So that's part of do that, the message for my wife. The second part is that I was looking at the Bhamsa last week for the first time in a number of years, and I noticed two things that are the first. One is I think the edition I saw had the Book of the Maccabees in it, which I don't think many other Siddurim have. The other thing is a very odd thing that if you look at Oz Yashir, at the very end, he leaves out a pasuk, which everybody else includes. And I wonder if you have any explanation for that.
Thank you, Marty. So on your first point, he does include in the Seder Megillas Chashmonaim, which is really interesting. It's not the Book of the Maccabees, actually. It's a different work. And it used to be in more places, like actually, I think there were, I'm trying to remember now, there were shuls that even read it on Hanukkah maybe, and maybe the Yemenites or something like that still use it. But yeah, he does include it on the Siddur, which is indeed interesting. It's not typically included in most Siddurim, today. With regard to Oz Yashir, there is a pasuk at the end, which some Siddurim include and some don't. And sometimes it's in parentheses. I think that might be what you're talking about. And I don't know offhand what the rationale is for either including it or not including it. Okay. Asher, you've been raising your hand. What?
I just wanted to point out a neighbor of mine is my next door neighbor is quite expert in all of these things, has a lot of these Siddurim and things from the Hebrew National and so on. And he pointed out that the language of thee, thou, thy, etc., the retention of that language is very important because the word you in English has no differentiation between the plural and the singular, the masculine and the feminine, and so on. And so retaining that kind of language is very important in the context of this talking about God and so on. That grammar is important.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly a valid rationale. For whatever reason, and we have not retained it in language, and I think because of that, it often strikes us as odd now and might actually take us out of, like, the translation, and it's going to be harder to appreciate. I guess there were two Ashers raising their hands. So Asher Reamer, now, something you wanted to say also?
Yeah, when it comes to translation of certain things like Pirkei Tehillim in the davening, was that his own translation or did he use somebody else's?
I'm not 100% sure, but I assume that it's his own. He generally did all his own translations. He was very into Hebrew language and translation. I'm assuming that he did it on his own. And the Chumash, for example, he did his own translation of the whole Chumash. Again, not widely used today, not really used at all, but he did do that. And let's see. Okay. Rabbi Shudnow says that JTS was not conservative at the time, was supported by conservative Judaism. We always use Orthodox term instead of proceeding. Sure, yeah. I mean, JTS is very different then also, and I pointed that out in an earlier class than it is today. And like these denominational labels don't apply well to early institutions, JTS being, you know, foremost among them, but even to other ones too. I mean, the fluidity between what was an Orthodox shul, what was a conservative shul during early periods was also very much up for grabs. Ruth talks about it being given as a graduation present in the sample, which is interesting. That's the Birnbaum Siddur? Yeah, 1949. Okay. Yeah, very interesting. Larry says a little more about the gravestone. Well, I will
and
say
the Shulamit school was created by Professor Saul Lieberman's wife.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and Larry talks about the gravestone. I will say that I did notice the error and then like make the connections to try to get it repaired, but without Larry, I couldn't have done it either. So he was able to do the fundraising, and he knew they had the contacts in the show and stuff like that. So it was certainly, you know, everyone was really instrumental in making that happen. I'm really glad that we were able to do that. Okay. Anything else?
I'd just like to reinforce that the business about JTS and its nature. My late brother-in-law was a graduate many years ago of JTS, and the certificate, they don't call it a smicha certificate. I forget exactly what the terminology is that's used, but many of the names that were in those acknowledgments were on his that certificate.
So interesting.
Which they stopped doing at a certain point, but it was a creation that actually it was Rabbi Yitkare v'Chacham Yitkare, because it came from the Sabbat Moreas period. Mm. You know.
Did you know my brother-in-law, Marvin Labinger? Rabbi Marvin Labinger?
Yes.
You knew him.
The great rabbis, all of them, whether they were Dr. Finkelstein, Dr. Lieberman, or Professor Chacham Jose Faur, all of my teachers, they were certainly not part of conservative Judaism. They were way up there and had titles, but they were part of Shmirat Shabbat, Shmirat Torah Umitzvot.
Oh, for sure. Yes. And thank you for that clarification. I will say that when JTS originally, they were not giving like traditional smicha, I think, when they started. And that's why I believe Mordechai Kaplan, actually, when he was going to become appointed the rabbi in New York of Kilat Jeshurun, he actually went to Europe to get another smicha.
He went to Europe, and I think got Rabbi Reines to give him
smicha. Rabbi Reines gave him smicha, yeah. So Rabbi Reines gave him smicha. Yeah.
And I would add one other thing. That Dr. Birnbaum was very, very much a promoter of Hebrew language. He stuck with Hadar as it was sinking. He went down with the sinking ship. He tried to persuade me once when I wrote something for tradition. He helped me translate it. I should publish it in Hadar. So for a time, Hadar was the place. And he was very much interested in promoting Hebrew. Unfortunately, the world went beyond him and past him, and he was ended up as a very private person. I admire you that you were able to ferret out all this bio, because he sat three or four rows behind me at the Jewish Center, and you could never find out anything. We had to search diligently to find even remote relatives of his. He had some second cousins or something still living in Israel, but it was not easy to find them. And he lived the life alone right down on 86th Street. But you deserve a lot of the credit, Yosef, for having pushed it and pulled it to fruition.
Thank you so much, Larry. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I hope I've done something to illuminate his life, because I do think it's worthwhile. And as I said, I have another article on him coming out soon in Chakira, so there's a little more of the biography. Again, we only know so much. I think I presented to you as much as we know.
Is Hadar digitized? Can you
No,
get
I was about to ask you about that also. So I think that would be a great, I don't know, some. I hope it does get, it's not digitized. I've looked. I had to, it's, it, you have to kind of pull it kind of in person from libraries. But yeah.
Who could do it? A Safaria might do it.
Yeah,
it
maybe. Yeah, I think it would be great to digitize Hadar. Yeah, because there is so much there. And there's just,
and you have articles in which the Rav and Heschel would debate halacha in the pages of Hadar.
That's
and that's
so
all completely lost now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Here is from Mossad Rav Kook, Paltiel.
Yes.
Yes,
that is a collection of his Hebrew essays, some from Hadoar and some from other publications. Yes, and that's an important work also. Not as widely known, but yes, thank you for showing that to everyone. Okay, well, thank you everyone so much.
Terrific presentation. We look forward to the next one.
Yeah, and we've got one more on the RCA sitter and the history of the RCA sitter, which is more interesting than I realized. So we will conclude with that next time and see you all again next week. And have a good day.
Thank you so much.